Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, June 20th, 2025, and our friend Graham Fuller is back with us. Welcome back, Graham.
Thank you, Nima. My pleasure.
Graham, Israel finally, Netanyahu finally achieved what he wanted to achieve was for such a long time, attacking on Iran. And how do you find the way that they attacked Iran? And we've learned from inside Iran, those people who were captured by the intelligence said they were collaborating with Israel for more than 10 years to prepare everything for this. 2 days before the talks were supposed to be the United States and Iran were supposed to talk to each other on Sunday, and on Friday, Israel attacked Iran. The same happened, if you remember, with the talks between Russians and Ukrainians.
Exactly.
Days before, the same sort of attack, drones going in and hitting the strategic parts of Russia. But somehow the escalation in Iran, the attack on Iran was different, because a combination of what has happened in Lebanon, decapitation, and what has happened in Russia, the drone attack in Russia. Your take on what has happened?
Well, the war obviously is getting quite vicious in a different sense. War is always terrible and people always die. But when you start conducting foreign policy by assassination, I think you're getting into very dangerous ground. The difference between assassination of leadership and regime change may not be that great. And Netanyahu and Israel have always sought regime change within Iran. So I'm not surprised at this. I don't know how the story was. I don't know how true it is. The story was that Trump told Netanyahu not to attempt to kill the Grand Ayatollah. And maybe that's true. I would not be surprised if Netanyahu went ahead and tried to do that in any case, to kill the Grand Ayatollah. But you know, things don't always work out the way you want. The follow-up leadership may be more angry and may be more capable, and in the case of the Grand Ayatollah, obviously much younger leadership. So that I'm not sure that, even from an Israeli perspective, that a new leadership, religious or secular, in Iran would be more friendly or desirable for Iran. And now we hear, not surprisingly, that lots of Iranians who do not like the regime are coming together in the face of this common enemy attack by a foreign enemy.
Russia pointed out that even if they assassinate the supreme leader of Iran, the power in Iran is so much consolidated. They know what they do. They are various parts of the government can take over. They can manage everything inside the country. It doesn't seem that would be, if you kill the leader of Iran, the supreme leader of Iran, that wouldn't change anything in Iran. I don't know if they would do that. And they make a huge mistake. Look at what's happening right now between Iran and Israel. I don't see Israel being capable of continuing the war of attrition that they've started.
Yes, it's very difficult to know exactly what kind of damage that Iran has inflicted on Israel, but it's very carefully controlled, and the news, nobody is covering it. But as you know, from other informed sources say that apparently there has been considerable damage in part cities like Tel Aviv and Haifa. But I think it's not just the actual damage to specific buildings. I think it's the psychological warfare that Israelis have never, except for occasional small terrorist attacks here and there in the past, Israelis have never had to suffer those kinds of attacks or feel insecure in the way that this has gone on. So that I think Netanyahu is in a very difficult situation if Israelis feel that they are no longer secure and they're being dragged into a very dangerous future. It doesn't stop there because, as we know, anti-Semitism now is growing all over the world. There are some people who are anti-Semitic, maybe always, but this is giving very clear ground to people who are, they're not anti-Semitic necessarily, but they end up hating Israel and angry at Israel. And this promotes anti-Semitism as well. So I think from an internal, a security point of view for Israelis, they must feel much, much more nervous. I think, you know, even American Jewish students say they now feel uncomfortable on American campuses. It's not anti-Semitism as such, but it's people who are angry at Israeli policies. And maybe if somebody says they're Jewish, then somebody will say, well, why is your government doing that? So there's a lot of pressure, psychological pressure, on Israeli society, Jewish society.
How do Russia and China see what's going on in the Middle East? How much of a threat that would be if the United States decides to escalate?
I think fairly clearly both China and Russia don't want to have anything to do with this war or get drawn into it. And certainly if the US comes into it, then this would open the prospect of a direct conflict between, say, the United States. I don't think China will be involved in this at all at this point. They're a little too far away. They're not quite as experienced in the complexities of Middle East policy. But Russia certainly doesn't want it. I think Russia maybe has even said that they have been delivering supplies or military supplies, but I don't know whether anyone knows exactly what that represents, whether they're missiles or radar or whatever. But I doubt that there will be a direct Russian American conflict in this direction. Russia, I think, has been quite open that it would like to resolve this nuclear issue. Nobody, basically very few great powers like Russia, will welcome proliferation of nuclear weapons. It just adds to the danger. Whether they're friendly or not friendly, it just adds to the danger. So I think Russia is quite sincere in trying to work out a way to satisfy the security needs of both Iran and Israel and other countries in the region through some kind of cooperation. I think even the UAE had talked about a joint, and Saudi Arabia, I think, also was interested in it, a possibility of developing
NPT. You're talking about the NPT.
No, I'm talking about the peaceful use of nuclear technology. For medicine and agriculture and all kinds of things like this. And that if these three states, say, three or four states in the region could all get together and develop a nuclear scientific development, this could be easily monitored. Everybody could monitor it, and it would be to everybody's benefit. I think Iran would probably go along with that. It would reduce the pressure against Iran's own nuclear, scientific nuclear development. I'm not talking weapons. I'm talking scientific. You know, there's thousands of uses of nuclear elements in many, many fields that have nothing to do with the military.
Exactly. In agriculture, desalination, various branches of the science, they're using it in Iran right now as we talk. Yeah. But Graham, we know that the United States, without the United States letting Israel to attack Iran, that was not possible. Even with the Biden administration, with all that said, we know that the Biden administration, we talked before. That was the worst administration, all of that. But they didn't let Netanyahu to attack Iran. We know that, actually, from the intelligence, from the media, we've learned about that. But Donald Trump has decided to let Netanyahu do what he wanted to do for such a long time. What was the main reason in his mind, in your opinion?
You know, Donald Trump is a very difficult figure to either predict or fully understand. He's very mercurial. He changes his mind very frequently. He's not necessarily well informed on these issues. He's impulsive. So that makes it more difficult for other states to know how to deal with him exactly. In this case, many people believe that Trump was very serious about wanting to be the peace president. I myself was very encouraged by that, and Trump made a lot of encouraging noises and comments about dealing with Russia, that he would talk, you know, he would be happy to talk to the Iranians and talk to any of the so-called enemies. But for reasons nobody knows quite fully, this seems to be a struggle actually for the American soul between Israel and America's own needs. And at this point, so many American observers have said that the power of the Israeli lobby is overwhelming, that that you if policies fly in the faces of what Israel wants, then Congress will never support it. It's hard to know exactly how far you can go. I think so many people in the world, including even in the US Congress, have been so shocked and appalled and horrified by this genocide operations within Israel that Israel is losing some degree of its support that it usually could count on. So I don't, and you know, who has whispered in Trump's ear most recently? Maybe somebody tells him one thing, somebody tells him something. Nobody can really predict this, but I agree. I think he seems to more recently been swayed more towards policies sought by Netanyahu than he has by earlier, more commonsensical views of his own. It's far from over. We don't know where this has gone. When Trump says he hasn't made up his mind whether he's going to join Israel or not, and that he'll tell us in 2 weeks, that's not all bad. I think he wants to see the way things go. I think preferably he would not. I think if it looks like there's no need for American involvement, that he would be very happy not to have to become involved. It could be that Israel itself would decide that this is not a successful operation and might pull back and ask for negotiations in some way. Maybe Trump is hoping for that. But there's so many factors. Who has Trump's ear? That I don't know where it will go, but I suspect it's not as positive at all as Israel had hoped.
We've learned that Israel received 14 weapon shipments from the United States and Germany since this war started. This war started this last Friday. It's been 6-7 days in the fight, and they received 14 weapon shipments. The latest shipment were carrying the missiles for the air defense system of Israel. And the other article in the Financial Times, also it was in the New York Times as well, that Israel is running out of missiles for air defense system. How can you decide to go to war with a country that you know has a lot of missiles, and you know that your air defense system are incapable of fighting a war of attrition? They know what we've learned from the war in Ukraine. It was almost incredible. Incredible amount of information came out of the war between Russia and Ukraine. Then, with all that said, you decide to go to war with Iran when you know the fragility on your part.
I don't think Israel fully understood what it was getting into. I'm sure there's lots of intelligence reports saying what kind of missiles they have, but I think there's always been a certain degree of arrogance on the part of Israeli military, feeling that they're comfortably in control of most situations and that they can decapitate leader after leader, and they have done so very skillfully, as you know, in taking out Hamas and Hezbollah leaders and others. But I think I don't think Israel was quite aware of what was going on. I think they believed that perhaps a surprise attack, as did take place when Iran was not expecting it, that might change the game. They maybe hoped, you know, all kinds of people whisper in Israel's ear too, and people who hate the regime and say, oh, everybody hates the regime, and if you kill the Ayatollah or whatever, that people would be out and dancing in the streets and the regime will fall apart and everything will change and it's the end of the Islamic Republic. Maybe they believe some of this. Also, there are a lot of Iranian Jews, as you know, not all of whom necessarily hate the regime, but you can, if Israel is looking for spies, for sympathetic actors among the population in Iran, they might find some of them among Jewish population, but not even just Jewish. There may be other minorities, Baluchis or
mostly I have never heard of the Jewish community collaborating with Israelis. Most of these people are just other groups of people that are collaborating with Israel, and they've been doing this. They tried to do this for, as I've mentioned, for a decade. They were preparing for this attack. That was the end game of Netanyahu. Do you think that Netanyahu, with what's going on in Israel right now, Iran has reduced the number of missiles that are hitting at Israel, but they're getting, each and every one is hitting the target. Not all of them, but most of them. And when you look at Israel and in the aftermath of the attack on Iran, do you feel that Netanyahu has achieved what he wanted to achieve, or he's going to be in a very dire situation in the aftermath of any peace treaty, any sort of settlement between the two parties?
No, I think he has not remotely achieved what he would like to achieve. Certainly, there have been some, I don't know how you'd measure, successful attacks on some of these nuclear installations. But let's remember that the public goal has always been to take out the so-called Iranian threat of nuclear developments. But that is not the end of the game. The end of the game is to destroy Iran, basically, fundamentally destroy Iran as a major geopolitical player in the Middle East. Israel sees only Iran left as a significant long-term geopolitical rival. I would add that I think they should not exclude Turkey as well, because I think Turkey is not in general on board with Israel or very sympathetic to it. But that's another issue, and that involves other complexities. But Netanyahu, if he destroys the nuclear production, facilities in Iran, that will be something of an accomplishment. But everybody knows that these facilities can ultimately be restored within weeks, months, etc., depending on what it is. But if he has not really destroyed the Islamic Republic, I think he hopes to actually change it ideologically. I think that's quite foolish and a fantasy, but because Iran is going to be permanently suspicious of the entire Western agenda, This doesn't even just about Israel, or you know perfectly well how both Mossad in particular and the United States joined together for regime change and overthrew Iran's very first elected prime minister, Mossadegh, back in the day in 1953. So there's deep suspicion towards the West in Iran, based on on events that have taken place. So I'm sure you can have a different Iranian regime, maybe more democratic, who knows, but I don't think it's suddenly going to embrace the West with love, as people thought perhaps the Iraqis would all embrace the American invasion against Saddam Hussein. It never happened. The opposition was still there after Saddam was killed.
As you've mentioned, Donald Trump said that within the next 2 weeks, he's going to decide if he's going to join Netanyahu's war on Iran. And British media, by the way, they're somehow, the role of the British in Ukraine. But the British media, I've never heard any media in the United States talking about it. The first and the last one was the British media talking about the use of tactical nuclear weapons against Iran, Donald Trump using them. Do you think, if let's assume that the British are right, that Donald Trump would use those type of weapons, what would be the consequences of that sort of attack on Iran?
Well, as we have been talking just now, Nima, I think that the British are playing one of the most dangerous and irresponsible games of almost any state in the West, certainly even more dangerous or irresponsible than Washington. And I think the British mindset is that they've never quite gotten over the loss of empire, global empire, and with the loss of that empire, have been struggling to reassert their power and position and influence, and see themselves as riding the U.S. pony or the U.S. horse to be the brains to the American muscle, and trying to influence and maintain both in Ukraine as well as in other parts of the Middle East. I think this is extraordinarily irresponsible of talking about tactical nuclear weapons. It's not only a question of just how much explosive power these weapons have, it's a psychological and technological threshold that once you cross that, you're in a brand new world. And you can say, well, it's a small tactical nuclear weapon. Well, what's to say that the next nuclear tactical weapon will be bigger and bigger? Where is the threshold? Where is the dividing line? It's not there. I think Trump understands. I think the Pentagon understands that, basically, that you're on a very dangerous, slippery slope and nobody wants to go there. So the British are, wildly irresponsible in promoting that line. I don't think it's going to happen because of it is such a significant psychological and military barrier. But I would not rule it out in the case of Netanyahu. I mean, this guy is apocalyptic. I mean, he may not personally be all that much, but, the Jews is the chosen people and God is on their side. Did you see this really quite shocking letter from the American ambassador, Mike Huckabee, in Israel, who wrote to Trump? I think it was Trump's birthday or something. I don't know. But he said to Trump, he said, God saved you for this mission when you got the bullet in your ear. God preserved you so that you could carry out this mission and ultimately fulfill and bring Israel to, its complete, its future state. And you will be famed for the rest of time if you undertake this kind of activity. He's clearly talking about nuclear things. This is, again, insane, But I think even Trump in his more irrational moments really doesn't want to go there. But the pressures are there. And if Netanyahu does something, who will respond? Will Iran use tactical nuclear weapons in response back? Will Pakistan maybe decide that they would like to contribute their existing nuclear capability? These are huge and dangerous questions.
For those people who don't know Iran, they say that Iran says death to America, death to Israel. But when you come from the society, Iranian society, you understand, I understand what's going on in Iran, in the mindset of Iranians, because the main problem, Graham, is not the United States. The main problem is what's going on in Palestine with the Palestinians. That's why Iran is talking this way, because they see Israel, the actions of the Israeli government and the way that the United States is helping them. I can guarantee you that there is no animosity toward the United States as being the United States without supporting Israel in what they're doing in Gaza. If they decide not to support Israel, Iran has no problem with the United States. And the other thing, Graham, that is somehow important to be considered is that why did Iran decide not to pursue nuclear weapons? What do they want? Where do they want to use these weapons? It would be at Israel if they want to use it. So why do they use nuclear weapon against Israel while they can kill a lot of Palestinians, when they can destroy all the land and destroy everything in Palestine? It's unbelievable that they would never do that. Anybody who understands what's the mindset of what's going on, the animosity between Iran and Israel, would never think that Iran would attack Israel with nuclear bomb. It's unbelievable. I don't know why for the United States so much difficult to understand Iran would never, even in the worst case scenario, if they achieve nuclear weapon, they would never use it against Israel because of Palestinians.
Well, Nima, I mean, with smaller nuclear weapons, you could use them against Israel proper without necessarily directly involving.
But in Israel proper, there is a lot of half the population are Palestinians.
I know. I know, but I'm not. You tell that to Zionist organizations, and they won't. That won't change their mind whatsoever. There's this slightly apocalyptic mentality. It goes back deep into Jewish history and the whole Holocaust and all of this kind of thing. These are apocalyptic visions, and I think they are. Frankly, Iran has certainly made very volatile and remarks about Israel in the past that would suggest that it would like to destroy the state of Israel. I'm not saying this is official policy at all, but among hardliners, there are probably those who would say that. So is the Israeli press, the Zionist press picks us up all of it. But I would say most people in the West, and certainly Europe as well, believes that Iran would like to destroy Israel if it could. It probably not true. But the problem is the perception, and I don't know how you go about changing that particular perception. And then right now, with this going on for the first time, bombs falling, missiles falling in Tel Aviv and Haifa, maybe this has awakened some sort of apocalyptic view within, the Israel, the Samson option of having to bring down the whole world if necessary to save Israel. I don't know, but it's not just a military issue. It's a deeply psychological, cultural issue in which the deep insecurities of Israel, of Jews, for good reason in part, the whole Holocaust experience and anti-Semitism in Eastern Europe for centuries. There are there's soil is the soil is there to receive the seeds of suspicion and fear among Jewish population, whether they're Zionist or not.
There is a decision to make in Israel in the aftermath of this attack, with considering what's going on in between Iran and Israel. They want to be the Israel of what Netanyahu represents. They want to be an Israel that would make some sort of understanding of what's going on in that, in the region, and maybe decide to do whatever the international community is trying to. They're talking about two-state solution. Some people are talking about one-state solution. Everybody has a vote, and they can decide about the future of the country that would exist in Israel, in Palestine. I don't see that Donald Trump would be able to achieve that. Do you feel that Donald Trump would move toward that? This war, you talk about this war cannot last as the war in Ukraine lasted for more than 3 years. It's impossible. It's impossible to continue this war. What is going on, in your opinion, in the mindset of those people in Washington?
Well, as you know, the talk of a two-state solution has been the mantra in Washington for maybe 30 years. I mean, ever since I've been involved in the Middle East, everybody's always talked about the two-state solution. I think, to me and to many other people who know the region pretty well, had came to the conclusion that however nice an idea in theory it is, that Israel has been working desperately hard to, as they say, create facts on the ground to make a two-state solution impossible. And now with sending all these settlers into, it's not just Gaza, into the West Bank, chopping down Palestinian olive trees and burning Palestinian homes there, it makes it very, very difficult to imagine how you could have a two-state solution. I don't want to say it's impossible if people are truly committed to this and feel that the alternatives are so terrible that we have to have a two-state solution, and we're going to force the Israelis and force the Palestinians, and to the degree that Jordan is involved, impose this on everybody. But I don't see this as an immediately realistic solution. And we know that Israel and Netanyahu, and it's not just Netanyahu, all of his right-wing people around him are absolutely opposed, have been opposed to it. I think Bibi himself has been opposed to the two-state solution going way, way, way back. But he didn't want to say it for two reasons. One, he didn't want to upset. He wanted to play for time. And if you say, yes, yes, we'll have a two-state solution, but meanwhile, I'm working very hard out here to make it impossible. There is that factor. But we have to consider the ideological, the messianic view almost of Zionist ideology that it's not just about Gaza, it's about greater Israel. It has religious implications. It's all about, of course, Jordan and parts of Lebanon and parts of Syria, and there are even supposedly parts of Saudi Arabia that potentially go back into biblical times of maybe Jewish settlements, whatever else. And it isn't even just the Bible, but it is the sense of power. Netanyahu and probably most so-called realist Israelis, I have this vision of being the dominant hegemon in the Middle East. And the only state that is blocking that possibility right now anyway is Iran. And it's been that way for quite some time. I just mentioned that I thought I would not exclude Turkey from that, because Turkey is not pro-Israeli, and Turkey is a powerful and important civilizational state in its own way. Maybe Saudi Arabia down the year road, who knows, might have. But essentially, right now, Iran is seen as the single threat, not just nuclear power or nuclear weapons, but to the entire Zionist hegemonic project.
To wrap up this session, Graham, you mentioned Turkey, and I know that you are interested in what's going on with the case of Turkey and the internal policy or foreign policy of Turkey in the Middle East, in the West Asia. How can you evaluate the behavior of the government in Turkey, Erdogan? And this attack on Iran was somehow different from what we've seen so far in the Middle East. It's a new escalation. We haven't heard before, we haven't seen before anybody attacking Israel the way that Iran is attacking Israel. It's something new. It's something new. And how do you see the policy on the part of Turkey?
I think, first of all, that Turkey, the overall population, I'm not talking about just Erdogan as president or elites, the entire population of Turkey, I think, is deeply pro-Palestinian, sympathetic to the Arab cause, the Islamic cause. There are all kinds of brotherhoods, Islamic brotherhoods. They're not necessarily violent at all. I mean, Muslim Brotherhood or other things, they're not violent organizations, but Sufi brotherhoods that follow, that are very concerned with Islam, with the Muslim world, with the fate of Muslim populations. And I think they would be, Turkey will almost never be likely to support Israel in any of these things, and would have its own reason to, for fear that maybe once Iran is removed, that Turkey could be the next state to be weakened, not part of greater Israel, but to be weakened and sidelined. So I think Iran is going to have to worry about Turkey, and that's not going to change in Turkey. It is a secular government, but religious impulses among Sufi brotherhoods and that kind of thing are very, very deep. And we briefly mentioned Pakistan as well, the other nuclear Muslim state. There has been talk that Turkey has often said that if they ever got into deep trouble, that they could look to Pakistan for help. Not that Pakistan would fight on Turkey's side, but they could deliver lots of weaponry, including maybe even nuclear power for Turkey to use. But Nima, if I can just pull back a little further on the screen here, I think we are seeing a massive geopolitical shift now and across the entire Middle East that's been underway now for a little bit of time. But if we think about Israel and Palestine, this is just a tiny little piece of it. The United States, for example, has been working for 30 years to create enemies. That's its standard tactic, is to create enemies and then try to get people to join the military alignments against these so-called enemies. But has been working to identify Iran as the enemy, as you know, and pushing the Saudis and pushing UAE and pushing Oman and pushing all these other states in the region that this is the danger and you have to join in our military alliance against Iran. That's how we're going to do it. Well, that began to fall apart. And in one brilliant, the first step, brilliant move, when a year or two ago, China became involved in negotiations between Saudi Arabia and Iran to try to overcome the problem and bring about a peaceful resolution of relations between them. And that is now working. No, Saudis may not end up loving Iranians. That's not the point. The point is that they have decided they do not want to have a hostile relationship. And this is holding up. We've had visits back and forth from. So At this point, you have a Arab world, especially in the Gulf, let's say the Gulf, that is by and large united and deciding that they do want to work with Iran. They don't want war. That's the last thing they need. This little state of Oman on the edge of the Persian Gulf. Omanis are very bright people and they're natural diplomats, and they've been working for years to bring about these things. So the Omanis have been working on such similar negotiations. So it seems that the simplified version of Arabs versus Persians is just not working anymore. And at this point, given Israel's genocide against Palestinians has horrified most of the world, not even just Muslims, most of the world, that Israel enjoys very, very little sympathy on this. So at this point, Nima, I could almost say, given the U.S. support for this war against the Palestinians, and now indirect backing so far, and maybe it will be bigger backing against Iran, maybe we are really seeing a new Zionist bloc, which is the United States and Israel. Because the United States is, of course, mainly not Zionist, but it's Zionists who are running U.S. foreign policy in the Middle East. At that point, we were talking about this very small group. I think even Europeans would be getting a little bit nervous about getting too deeply involved in this. But the Americans and the Israelis are simply going to be out of the picture as these movements like BRICS grow, of which Iran is a member, and so many other states in the region are members, that it's redrawing the entire world in which a kind of neo-colonial American Zionist project is no longer there. But I don't think it's going to die in the U.S. for quite a long time. People have talked, American military strategists talked for years during the Cold War about how Israel was the unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Mediterranean to support American ambitions. So you can see that's all coming apart. It's now just the U.S. and Israel, a Zionist bloc, if you will. And the rest of the world is not going to be comfortable with that or supportive of it. And I don't know how the U.S. is going to be able to get out from under this, given the power of the Zionist lobby in Washington. This truly could be a massive game changer, geopolitical massive game changer in that whole Middle Eastern, Southwest Asian region.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Graham, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Likewise, Nima. I always enjoy our discussions. Take care. Chodafes.
Chodafes.
Okay.